Welcome. My name is Todd Presner. I'm the director of UCLA's Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies. I know many of you here, and it's nice to see so many familiar faces. This is the last event of our winter quarter, and I can't think of a better event to end a really wonderfully stimulating journey that we've had this quarter than to welcome back a friend and colleague, Fabrizio Lelli. So today's lecture is really special for me because Fabrizio has had a long relationship with UCLA, has been here many times both as a visiting scholar and as a lecturer, and his work continues to inspire so many of us. So that's, I think, borne out by the audience here today. I also have the pleasure of introducing someone who many of you also know, Daniel Steinkaufen, who is our 2016-17 Viterbi Visiting Professor of Mediterranean Jewish Studies, based here in our Department of Italian. And Daniel is not only himself an indefatigable scholar in his own right, but is also working, as many of you know, to organize a conference next quarter on Jewish visual culture, and information about that conference is available in the back. He's a junior professor for Jewish literature and culture in Germany at the University of Greifswald, and he's also served previously as a postdoc at the Judaic Studies program at Yale. He'll be introducing our speaker today, and I just wanted to say a little bit about his background. His research interests span medieval and early modern Jewish-Christian relations, and he's published on numerous topics, including Renaissance humanism, Christian Kabbalah, and Jewish visual culture, again, the subject of the conference that we'll have in April, I believe. He's the editor of Hebrew Beyond Christians and Jews, which was just released in 2017, and the co-editor and translator of a number of volumes, including Renaissance Kabbalah introductory texts, and completing a book project called The Hebrew Question in the Italian Renaissance. He'll introduce our speaker today and also acknowledge our many co-sponsors. I do want to thank you all for being here, and particularly to thank the Viterbi program in Mediterranean Jewish Studies. Thank you.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to welcome you to today's Viterbi lecture with Fabrizio Lelli. Today's presentation has been generously sponsored by the Alan D. Levy Center for Jewish Studies, with additional support from the UCLA Department of Italian, the UCLA Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies, and the Italian Cultural Institute of Los Angeles. Warm thanks as well to the Levy Center and its staff for attending to all the logistics of today's lecture. In addition, I would like to acknowledge the presence here today of Dr. Andrew Viterbi, whose vision and generosity has made the Viterbi program in Mediterranean Jewish Studies at UCLA possible. Thank you very much for making the trip up to UCLA. And it is, of course, also my great pleasure to introduce and to welcome my friend Fabrizio Lelli back to UCLA. Fabrizio Lelli is Associate Professor of Hebrew Language and Literature in the Faculty of Languages of the University of Salento in the city of Lecce in Apulia, Italy. In addition, he has had fellowships and visiting appointments at a dazzling array of institutions: the University of Turin, the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, the Institute for Advanced Studies in Religious Studies in Florence, the Herbert Katz Center for Advanced Jewish Studies at the University of Pennsylvania on numerous occasions, and UCLA. And with regard to UCLA, I'll just note, as you heard, Fabrizio has been here on many occasions, and in fact, he was the inaugural Viterbi Visiting Professor in Mediterranean Jewish Studies back in 2006-2007. So we're very glad to have you back here today, Fabrizio. Professor Lelli's research activity focuses primarily on the philosophical and mystical literature of late medieval and early modern Italian Jewish authors, on which he has published numerous seminal studies from which I myself have benefited greatly. In recent years, he has turned his attention to the Jewish legacy of southern Italy, the subject of today's lecture. For example, in 2013, he edited a volume of collected articles on the Jews of Salento between the 9th and 16th centuries, and he is the curator of the permanent exhibit of the museum Palazzo Taurino, Medieval Jewish Lecce, which was opened in Lecce in May of 2016. But he has also become very engaged with the modern Jewish story in the far south of Italy, working to preserve the memory of the thousands of Jewish refugees who lived in United Nations transit camps in this region after World War II, about whom he, I believe, also curated an exhibit. So, on a personal note, let me just say that I have enjoyed spending time with Fabrizio and his lovely wife Flora in Florence and at academic events at various on various continents over the years, and I'm very glad to finally see him in Los Angeles. So please join me in welcoming Fabrizio Lelli, who will now speak on memory and continuity of the Southern Italian Jewish legacy. Welcome, Fabrizio.
So, good evening. Can you hear me? I guess so. Louder? You want me to speak louder? But it's very weird because generally I'm supposed to speak very loud. So, is it okay?
Yeah.
Okay? Let me know. So, thank you very much. I join my predecessors here in thanking the organizers of this lecture, of this major event here at UCLA, and I have to show my gratitude especially to Todd Pressner for inviting me here, to Sarah Stein, whom I've met last year in Lecce, and with whom we have started organizing, in a way, this project, this program last year. Of course, I can't but thank my old friends, my friends from lots of years, Shiro and Rose Finzi, who have been following my research activity in Lecce since I first met them in 2003. And of course, I can't but thank Andrew Viterbi for providing the means and all possible support for making this lecture possible. Thank you very much. Now, what I'm going to deal with today is a part of my research activity in Lecce and in Apulia in general. And I would like to show you what we are doing there. And my point is that of trying to let you understand how difficult for an historian, like I think I am, is to match or to merge memory and history. I'll try to explain you why, and I hope I will be clear. I don't know. If I'm not clear, please ask questions. Now, let's start. In contemporary Israeli literature, a significant number of novels and short stories shows a surprising reappraisal of the history of the Jewish diaspora. However, what both authors and fictional characters look for is a sort of mythological interpretation of their family memories rather than history. So I want to point out these specific relations, which is especially relevant, significant in Israeli literature in the last decades, at least. For instance, in his autobiographical novel Havalim, translated into English as The Pure Element of Time, Haim Be'er sheds light on his genealogy and seeks for the remote origin of his family in regions far from the land of Israel. His ancestors lived for centuries in the Rhine Valley. According to an allegedly old tradition handed down throughout centuries, they dwelt in mines in the 11th century and were related to a major figure of Ashkenazi Hasidism or pietism. His name was Kalonymos ben Kalonymos. Baer, the author of the novel, holds that Kalonymos moved to Germany from northern Italy. However, the author does not say, or maybe does not know, that the name Kalonymus was the Greek rendering of the Hebrew name Shem Tov, good name, and that this was a rather common name in the Byzantine Empire. For those who are familiar with the history of medieval southern Italy, the name Kalonymus recalls that of a very important Jewish family who lived in Apulia when the region located along the Adriatic coast, you know where Apulia is, was still ruled by the Byzantine emperors. In Baer's novel, the search for genealogical records intertwines history and myth. Present-day historians generally attempt to keep the two aspects separate. Is this really possible? As a scholar of Southern Italian Judaism, I'm also interested in the connections between what I may call a mythological reading of Jewish memory and real history. Reading Baer's novel recalled to my mind one of the most popular legends of medieval Ashkenazi Judaism. Coming from the east, the Kalonymus family settled in Apulia, the southernmost Italian region of the Adriatic Sea, around the mid-10th century, due to massive anti-Jewish persecutions in the Byzantine Empire and to Muslim raids along the Apulian coasts. They moved to northern Italy, whence a German emperor would have forced them to resettle in the Rhine Valley. It is at this point that legend becomes history, because we know that the Kalonymus largely contributed to the flourishing intellectual development of the Hasidei Ashkenaz mysticism by also introducing intellectual material from Byzantium and southern Italy into their new homeland. The mythical reading of the Kalonymus genealogy is certainly grounded in the historical migrations of Jewish communities from Apulia to northern Italy and to Germany. The family name Kalo, which derives from Kalonymus, is still nowadays rather common in Apulia, and many Apulian families are presently seeking evidence of purported Jewish origin in their family name in order to revive their Jewish background. In addition to names that seem to be Jewish, memories of Jewish traditions are kept in several Apulian cities, and especially in Trani, where once thrived one of the largest Jewish communities in southern Italy. According to a common interpretation, such memories would point out that until recently, traces of Jewish rites survived, though underground. This phenomenon can be compared with similar cases of Jewish memories kept in other areas where Jews were obliged to convert to Christianity. I'm thinking, for instance, of the well-known case of Belmonte in Portugal, or of other centers in present-day Spain or in New Mexico. Those same memories constitute a powerful motivation for Catholic individuals or families to convert to Judaism. A mythological reading of genealogical history deeply affects social and religious changes. Another significant case in southern Italy of mythological reading of history is that of San Nicandro, a small village in the northmostern area of Apulia. At the beginning of the 20th century, within the rural community of San Nicandro, some Catholic people started paying significant attention to religious practices inspired by literal reading of the Old Testament, such as the observance of Sabbath and of biblical dietary laws and festivals. In 1931, a local farmer, Donato Manduzio, began organizing sessions of biblical study addressed to local workers. In a few years, the group led by Manduzio became a sort of non-Talmudic Jewish sect. that aim to live their daily life according to the Torah rules. Since Jews had been expelled from southern Italy in the 16th century, Manduzio and the members of his small community, originally named Sabbatini from Sabbath, were convinced that the people of Israel did not exist any longer. Later on, however, Manduzio found out that Jews had not disappeared and that some could be found in Naples, Rome, and other Italian cities. This surprising discovery pushed Manduzio to write letters to the chief rabbi in Rome, asking that he convert him along with the rest of his group. It took years and the end of World War II before the Sabbatini of San Nicandro could be officially converted to Judaism. Then, in 1949, most of them decided to make Aliyah and to settle in Israel, where the descendants still live in the area of Tzfat and Galilee. A recent Israeli documentary movie entitled Tzfat San Nicandro at His Travel focuses on the moving relationship between the Israeli community of San Nicandro and their Apulian-based relatives. The traditions of this peculiar Jewish community, which nowadays counts about 50 members, are the object of several research projects carried out by the newly established Jewish community of Trani. Scholars focus their attention on the development of the San Nicandro liturgy, which was mostly carried out in the local Italian language and accompanied by hymns composed in the local Apulian dialect. From a historical perspective, the origin of this Jewish community should be sought in the major circulation of Protestant religious traits among San Nicandro people whose families had migrated to the U.S. at the beginning of the 20th century. However, the mythological reading that the San Nicandro Jews created after leaving for Israel made them believe that they were descendants of southern Italian Anusim, that is, of Jews forced to conversion, and they were now returning to their pristine faith. The same mythological reading of memory triggered the recent conversion in northern Apulia of other Catholic families to Judaism. I just mentioned the new community of Trani. Following in the footsteps of the San Nicandrians, a bunch of Apulian families stressed their crypto-Jewish traditions. The 13th century synagogue in Trani has thus become a moving sign of historical renewal. This Gothic building, one of the oldest synagogues still in use in Italy, dates back to 1247, though shortly after its construction it was converted into the church of Santa Maria di Scolanova, this name being a clear hint at its Jewish past. Scolanova, of course, means new school, neue Schule, new synagogue. In 2005, the building was returned by the municipality of Trani to the new Jewish community. The older and larger 13th century synagogue in Trani, once called Scuola Grande, large, big school, which soon became the Church of St. Anne, now hosts the Museum of Apulian Judaism that opened a few years ago after a careful restoration of the ancient building. The two buildings, Scuola Nova and Scuola Grande, represent the modern interpretations of Jewish memories, one based on mythological rereading of Jewish past, and the other one on a historical and philological exam of extant documents. However, the first case is lively, as it creates and renovates new religious and social phenomena, whereas the second memory only concentrates on a philological interpretation of documents. Which of the two memories should be deemed as more legitimate in the contemporary historian's perception. A few months ago, a new museum was opened in Lecce, which focuses on the history of Jewish communities in late medieval Salento, the region of Lecce, southern Apulia. Being myself the curator of the permanent exhibit housed in Palazzo Taurino, I thought that the aim of the museum should be first and foremost that of providing regular visitors, I mean profane visitors, people who are not scholars, a correct information about the history of a significant minority that thrived in 15th century southern Apulia. While trying to figure out what to display in the museum, I wondered whether I should present only historical material or merge some elements of the mythological reading of memory, which I mentioned before. I must confess that I eventually made the decision to limit the analysis of the documentary material to philological interpretation. However, I tried to let people understand the complex issue of Jewish collective memory that made it possible to southern Italian Jews that were obliged to leave their homeland, Puglia, Apulia, in the 15th and 16th centuries, to bring their local traditions with them and to keep those traditions alive for centuries. The location of the museum is of special significance, as it is housed in a late Renaissance building that stands on the site of the 15th century synagogue of Lecce. In other words, although the traces of the Jewish presence in Lecce have disappeared because that synagogue doesn't exist any longer, it was destroyed, so even if those traces disappear throughout time, the local memory made it possible to name a street of the old city, of the old center of Lecce, Via della Sinagoga, Synagogue Street, for people, for present-day people, to remember that in previous centuries a synagogue had been there. During the restoration work before the opening of the museum, traces of that memory resurfaced and the mezuzah reappeared on a doorpost in the main courtyard of the Palazzo Taurino. Here I show you the plan, the layout of the museum, and you see that the area marked in red shows a room, it's called camera, and which has a very strange shape. At a careful analysis after restoration, we found out hidden in the walls of this chamber, of this room, some columns which might be parts of an existing church which should have replaced the synagogue which would be there. So in our opinion, this room still keeps the traces of the old synagogue of Lecce, though turned into a church. And then it was really surprising for us to see that besides some capitals and other decorative elements related to this old religious building converted into church, we found the mezuzah in the courtyard. And so this is very interesting because it's an evidence that this was exactly the place of the synagogue, or at least it was part of the major Jewish neighborhood in Lecce, which is now almost completely lost after the total reconstruction of the area in 16th and 17th century. What we may say about southern Italian Judaism, in my opinion, may be used to describe also other Jewish diasporas. Contemporary researchers should keep in mind that in order to document the history of Jewish communities that resided in a specific area, they should ground their analysis in both archaeological and archival evidence. However, even a philological analysis of such documents must take into account the metaphorical and fictitious reconstructions carried out throughout centuries by both Jews and non-Jews while recording or reviving those memories. Is memory to be seen as opposed to history, or we should try to harmonize the two of them? The first tendency lets us believe that memory creates myths and is uncritical from a philological perspective. The second tendency tries to support historical truth by myth. In the newly opened museum in Lecce, we stress the well-documented historical evidence that Jews arrived in Apulia from the east, both from the land of Israel and from the Balkans, that they resided for shorter or longer periods in Apulia and subsequently moved to other places where they kept the memory of their Apulian past alive. Thus, the legends collected by the Hasidei Ashkenaz in the Rhine Valley between the 12th and the 13th centuries may become a significant source of information on Apulian Judaism in previous centuries, as we lack archaeological evidence of the intellectual activities that were carried out in Apulia in the same period when the stories were put into writing. For from Bari shall come for Torah and the word of the Lord from Otranto. The French scholar, the 13th century French scholar who expressed these words, Rabbe Notam, lived in an area of the Western diaspora far away from Apulia. In order to praise the scholarly activity of Apulian centers, he replaced the names Zion and Jerusalem and the biblical verse of Isaiah with the cities of Bari and Otranto. We find here one of the best-known statements of the great role played by Apulian scholars and academies. However, historical evidence does not match with such mythical reading, since we only have a few documents that demonstrate a crucial loss of the prestige of the ancient Apulian academies in the 13th century. According to tradition, after the destruction of the Second Temple of Jerusalem in the year 70, Titus sent to Rome the members of the most outstanding priestly families of Jerusalem. They landed in Brindisi, the most important Roman seaport on the Adriatic Sea, where some families were allowed to settle. Living in Brindisi and in the surrounding area, the newly formed communities could more easily keep in contact with the land of Israel. Archaeological excavations in Apulia have proved the existence of important Jewish communities in this area already in the Roman imperial times, showing that Apulia was one of the earliest regions of Western European Jewish settlement. Still in later centuries, Apulian Jews were proud of being descendants of priestly families deported from Jerusalem. For instance, Achimatz ben Paltiel wrote in 1054 a genealogical work entitled Sefer Yuchasin, the Book of Genealogies, where he praises his own ancestors, stressing their main role of mediators between the land of Israel and Apulia. However, Achimatz was not born in Apulia, was born in Capua, near Naples, and had no longer contacts with Apulia, as his grandfather had left the city of Oria, where his family came from, near Brindisi. Should we believe Ahimat's words when he aims to demonstrate that his ancestors were so renowned that one of the most important Jewish scholars in 9th century Baghdad went to Oria, this very small city, just to meet them? In Ahimat's chronicle, is there any boundary between myth, ideology, and history? Archaeological evidence has proved that some of the tales contained in Ahimat's work are grounded in real historical events, but can we trust the medieval author when he emphasizes the importance of his own ancestors, who would have been responsible for some of the major historical events affecting the development of Judaism in Western Europe. Again, archaeological evidence allows us to maintain that Jewish communities in Apulia established important trading networks with the eastern shore of the Adriatic Sea, with northern Africa and the land of Israel. Thanks to the knowledge of several languages, Apulian Jews could play the role of cultural and commercial mediators with the eastern Mediterranean regions. It is not surprising, then, that the first documented text written in a Romance southern Italian language is a late 14th century exchange of letters between a Jewish merchant of Lecce and a Christian colleague of his from Venice. The two had set up a trading company that imported silk from the eastern Mediterranean and exported olive oil from Apulia. Beside the center of Oria, the main intellectual Jewish site in the Adriatic region was Otranto, whose Talmudic academy played a very significant role in the Middle Ages. We still have a number of manuscripts, mainly extant in fragmentary form, that were copied in Otranto by local scholars who commented on the Hebrew and Aramaic texts by using Italian words, which were transcribed in Hebrew characters. Some of the most ancient copies of Mishnah codices that have come down to us were copied in Otranto in the 11th century. In a manuscript which is now kept at the Biblioteca Palatina in Parma, the text of the Mishnah is accompanied by marginal notes that explain difficult Hebrew words in the local Italian dialects. This should be counted among the very first examples of the Italian written language. We find a trace of the major role played by Apulian rabbis in the circulation of Talmudic knowledge in a 12th century legend which tells of four rabbis who left Bari by boat to spread their learning throughout the Mediterranean. Taken prisoners on the high seas by Muslim pirates, they were redeemed in four different places: Tunisia, Egypt, Iberia, and Provence, where they established centers of Jewish learning which would later become the most outstanding schools in those regions. Is this a legend, or Rabbeinu Tam's words about Bari and Otranto can be deemed true? The early communities that had settled in Apulia in the Roman period and had later moved north toward Germany were replaced by Jews coming from across the Adriatic Sea from the Balkans. They probably introduced new liturgical elements in the pre-existing Apulian rite. A research project which is being carried out at my university in Lecce focuses on the specific features of this peculiar minhag. It is a rather complicated research, since we basically do not have any prayer books copied before the period when Jews were expelled from southern Italy at the beginning of the 16th century. Moreover, the scanty liturgical manuscripts which had come down to us were mainly written by Spanish exiles who had settled in the Kingdom of Naples after the 1492 Iberian expulsion. Since those exiles brought Sephardic traditions with them, they may have changed the original features of the pristine southern Italian rite. In order to better understand this complex issue, we have taken into account the liturgy of the community of Corfu, where many Apulian Jews sought shelter after the Spanish conquest of the Kingdom of Naples at the beginning of the 16th century. In Corfu, the Apulian community kept faithful to their original southern Italian rite. In the 18th century, when local Jewish families started leaving Corfu for Venice, they published a series of liturgical texts according to their ancient minhag. In those printed prayer books, we still find traces of the ancient dialects spoken by Apulian Jews in Corfu. This is the object of a research project carried out at the University of Lecce, which aims to collect all extant evidence of translations of Hebrew texts into the Apulian dialects during the Middle Ages. As said, Jews left Apulia when Spain started ruling over the area between the beginning and the first half of the 16th century. Many converted, probably taking their Judaism underground. Among the Jews who left southern Italy, many decided to head for the Balkan Peninsula. Once more, the Adriatic Sea played for the Jews the role of major vehicle to reach safer places. We have mentioned the case of the island of Corfu, but we may also think of many cities in the Ottoman Empire, particularly those located along the road which united Albanian seaports located just opposite the Apulian shores of the Adriatic and the capital of the empire, Istanbul. One of the major Apulian settlements was in Salonika, where at least three communities of Apulian refugees originated from different groups of exiles. Some other Jews moved by sea to Venice. In the Venetian Jewish society of the early 16th century, we witness an interesting cultural milieu made up of families who came from Apulia and who frequently intermarried with other southern Italian exiles. To a certain extent, the situation of the Apulian exiles in Venice was not too different than that of the Apulians in Corfu. Although in Venice the assimilation of southern Italian Jews with other Jewish identities took a shorter time to be achieved than in the remoter Ionian island. As a matter of fact, in present-day Corfu, the local community is still nowadays called Apulian community. They still speak an Italian dialect, though the Apulian linguistic traits have disappeared and have been replaced by Venetian elements. This is, again, clear evidence of the legacy of Apulian Judaism that can be found far from Apulia. The recently established Jewish Museum in Lecce shows the wide variety of material resulting from our research projects on the legacy and continuity of Apulian Judaism. Although the museum mainly centers on the late medieval Jewish settlement in Lecce, a room of the museum is consecrated to a more recent phase of Jewish Renaissance in Apulia. This phase is associated with the presence of Jewish Holocaust survivors and refugees in the Apulian transit camps, which were opened under the supervision of the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration at the end of World War II. This is another major branch of my research activity in Lecce, that aims to collect evidence of a very significant, though poorly investigated, phase of contemporary Jewish history or memory. When thousands of refugees spent months, sometimes years, in Apulia, leaving many signs of their presence behind, the memory of their stay resurfaces in the Hebrew inscriptions found in the walls, on the walls of buildings, which were temporarily turned into kibbutzim, Asharot, synagogues, or refectories. Marriage and birth records in the local city archives carry the evidence of a contemporary Jewish presence in Apulia. In the last few years, local cultural associations and political institutions, with the support of the University of Lecce, launched several projects aiming to collect extant material of that period in order to display it in the museum, which was opened in 2009 in Santa Maria al Bagno. Projects have included the creation of a website, this one, www.profughebraeinpuglia.it, which features photos of the refugees in the Apulian transit camps. The University of Lecce is also collecting the memoirs written in various languages by the refugees. Two movies on the subject of the DP camps were shot in Israel in the last few years, both dealing with the memory of such an interesting, though brief, period. I think one you probably saw recently, I don't know if the Cultural Institute, the Italian Cultural Institute.
It's on the web.
Yeah?
It's on the internet.
Yeah. after 500 years of almost total absence of Jews, Judaism is being rediscovered in Apulia, both as a living religious practice and as a rich study subject, which will help clarify many aspects of the complex shaping of Southern Italian cultural identity, resulting from the merging of memory, myth, and history. Thank you. I don't know if it was clear. If not, please ask questions.
Well, thank you very much for a very rich, wide sweeping, and I think clear. So yes, we have time for questions. So
it's many, many questions. See, Gershon immediately raises his hand.
what a fascinating story. I don't know, Fabrizio, whether you're familiar with the history of Jewish Narbonne. Are you?
I know something about.
Okay. Well, there's an incredible parallel between the story you've told about Bari, Otranto, and Narbonne. Narbonne Jewish community was founded probably in the 8th century, maybe 9th century, and is alleged mythologically to have been founded as a result of a shipwreck, just like the shipwreck we're talking about there. And the Jewish scholarship there was so great that Ravad, not the Ravad of Poitiers, but of Pasquier, but a different Ravad, wrote in the 12th century that he believed that Judaism in Europe really stems from Narbonne. And you tell me you're not familiar with this? Because this is an incredible parallel.
Yeah, thank you, Gershon, for this important information. I must say that, as a matter of fact, this is a sort of common tradition in other communities, in other Mediterranean communities. There generally is a shipwreck of people, of Jewish people who were deported from Jerusalem, generally after the destruction of the temple. And some, for instance, we find this in Crete. We find exactly the same story. Other Greek communities have the same story. And again, what I'm trying to demonstrate is, I think, as you pointed it out very clearly, is that we ground our historical research on documents. And we find many of these information in literary documents, which seems to be fictional piece of information, how to say. Sometimes they are partly true, sometimes they are not. But it's interesting that in the same areas and in different similar contexts, you find exactly the same stories, which probably points out to a similar route or similar origin of the stories, which may be partly true originally. So I think this is very important, and it's important for us to compare the stories and to try to define them as not only mythological or fictitious, but also historical.
But that's do you think the parallel minimizes the importance of the story, or do you, and suggests that it's a product of the hippocampus rather than reality?
You know, in recent years, scholarship has demonstrated the extent to which contacts between different Jewish European communities were established. So, for instance, I didn't stress enough the role of Apulian traditions in Ashkenaz. And so we know, for instance, now that there were very strong connections between the Rhine Valley and Provence, the area of Narbonne and Catalonia. So it might be that maybe, I don't know, I'm just trying to figure out, maybe the origin of the story is to be sought in the Mediterranean, the Eastern Mediterranean, maybe in Byzantium, because it was very common in the Byzantine world. Then it got, at some point, it got to Puglia. Then from Puglia, it reached out Germany or maybe Provence. And then we shouldn't forget that the contacts between, the commercial contacts between Provence and southern Italy were thriving, especially at a later stage in the Middle Ages. So it's very difficult to know who was the beginner, as usual. There's always a story says, I came before, I invented this before. It's very difficult to say, but again, it's important to compare the different stories and to see how it is possible to make comparisons and to demonstrate that there is a Mediterranean Jewish legacy which appears similar in different parts of the Mediterranean diaspora. Maybe.
My question is, well, I don't think you have to be a rock scientist. The Jews came with the Romans to Italy first. I don't have to be a rock scientist. And then you start expanding. So my question is, how is the Jewish community now, especially when there are so many Israeli Jewish women getting married to Italian Christians? Not just Jews, Christian, and what is the connection with the Libyan Jews? Because there are a lot of Libyans coming to Italy. Are the Italian Jews who went to Libya and now their descendants are returning? I'm curious about the connection.
So, can I ask you please to repeat the first question? I didn't.
Is the Jewish community now in Italy, especially when I understand that a lot of Israeli women, Israeli donne, as for Santo Italiani, make Catholic. So how is the connection? Are you aware of this happening in Italy? Are you aware? And how is the community? Or you can also answer the
now you were probably just one second you were pointing out something about Libyan Jews after
yes.
What's the connection with Libyan Jews?
Yes.
I didn't
were
catch
Italians
it
Italians who went to Libya
yes
because I know Italy colonized Libya
yeah
correct
yeah
and Italians who went to Libya and then their descendants came back to Italy
yeah
that's the connection.
But
I really the status of the contemporary Jewish community.
Yeah. So that because I want to point out some aspects of this question just to clarify maybe the situation. I'm not really familiar of this phenomenon you're describing of Israeli women going to Italy and getting married to Catholic. I mean, maybe there are. There certainly are Israeli women who. Yeah, but I don't think this is a very it's a major social phenomenon in Italy, at least not to my knowledge. I don't know. Whereas for what concerns the Libyan story, you know that Libyan Jews have two different origins. There were Libyan Jews before the colonization of Italy, which were originally Northern African of Sephardi or coming from French colonies or from the Livorno tradition, like in Tunisia, for instance. There were Jews who went to Libya and, let's say, colonized Libya with Italians. Okay, so there are two different communities, to put it this way. Now, after Libya reacquired its own independence, Italians were obliged to leave, were forced to leave, and of course Jewish communities as well left Libya, but not only because they were Italians, but also because of the creation of the State of Israel. And you know, you may know that, for instance, the present-day community in Rome has a big percentage of Libyan Jews, not only in Rome, but somewhere else in Italy you have that. But again, I don't see the connections of the two things. I mean, the Israeli women getting married to Catholics and
yes.
Yeah, or maybe somebody else can can respond.
Recently, I'm wondering in terms of separating memory and mythology from history, what use could be put to genetic DNA markings? So recently there was a study done that looked at genetic material for Jews all over the world, and they found it very similar. The people they found most having most in common with the Jews were the Italians. And that goes, I think, to the idea that the Jews have lived in Italy for as long as they have. In some of the things where you say, is this memory or history, would genetic DNA marker testing be of any aid? Would it be of any help?
That's a good question. I'm not a specialist in genetics, and I became familiar with these ideas while staying in the United States, because I know that here this is a rather popular idea, that of undergoing genetic testing, blood testing, in order to demonstrate affinities with European populations, let's call it this way. To my knowledge, but again, I might be mistaken, to my knowledge, genetic testing about Judaism or Jewish backgrounds and something like that, this is something I read some years ago. It might have changed in time. By blood testing yourself, you would demonstrate affinity with some Ashkenazi groups coming from Northern Europe, because probably most of the Jewish population of the United States had more familiarities, let's say so, with Ashkenazi groups coming from Northern Europe. So I don't see how possible to demonstrate, how possibly demonstrate the familiarity of Jews with Italian. It seems strange.
From your lecture, you talked about Renato.
Yeah,
who goes back and wants to be and converts back to Judaism.
Yes, but he knew he was not Jewish in a way. I mean, he thinks he had an affinity, an intellectual affinity from a religious point of view. But this is what the descendants of the Sanhedrins try to establish once they arrived in Israel. They try to establish the idea, to point out the idea that they had not converted to Judaism, but they had returned to Judaism because their ancestors had been forced at some point in history to convert to Judaism. In my opinion, again, from a historical point of view, there is no record. I mean, there is no trace. We know that there were a lot of mass conversions in southern Italy, for sure. We know. But it's very difficult to prove that those people in San Nicandro were definitely the descendants of those converted Jews. It's very complicated. It's an interesting point, though, because what I'm trying to define from a historical perspective is what was the perception of, let's say, communities in late Middle Ages, the period which I'm mostly familiar with, in Puglia, for instance. So, for instance, we have evidence that there are some places like northern Apulia, some major cities, seaports, that we know from documents that hosted a lot of Jews, particularly in the 15th century, many of them coming from Spain. There are some documents saying that at certain points the inhabitants of the cities were not considered as reliable as others, because other cities were saying, we don't trust them because they're Jewish. The whole population is Jewish. Which, again, is it true? Is it a way of defining a different identity, a different civic identity, which is the case in many Italian cities? I mean, the way to define oneself different than the others by saying I'm this and you are that, you know, these sorts of things. But again, it's interesting that they're pointing out that the most part of the inhabitants of the city has a Jewish background, which is potentially true from historical evidence, meaning that they could have been, could be mostly converted to Christianity, forced to convert to Christianity. And we know from documents that there were special laws and special statutes in late medieval southern Italy, in late medieval kingdom of Naples, concerning the communities of converts. So those communities were not entitled to follow the same rules as the Christians, although they were officially Christian, and were not Jews any longer. So there were something in between.
Carne
e carne e pesce, exactly. And this is exactly what was said about them. They were ne carne ne pesce, okay? So it's interesting, and this is something that should be investigated, because we don't have enough material, enough evidence about these major changes. You know, in northern Italy, you generally have the feeling that Jewish communities have always been very small. The Jewish presence has always been relatively small. But in southern Italy, we know that communities were relatively large. So what happened to those people? And this is another subject of debate, of course.
I'd like to point out that genetic testing is a very recent phenomenon, and it only has become a consumer product in the last 5 years or so. And so I wonder, it would be a very interesting research program to bring the people, the descendants of San Cassandro, to that. It's a little touchy, because if they get the wrong answer, you're very disappointed.
Yeah.
That's mainly for diseases.
Yes.
But yeah. It's not a blood test.
It's mainly for diseases.
Yeah.
It's not a blood test. It's a saliva test. You spit it. It's $90 or something.
Yeah.
You can find out
in the
lobby.
Yeah. Yeah. In the back.
I came in a little late, so I apologize. I wanted to know what percentage of the Jewish population was in Puglia, and where did they actually, was it Bari, was it Foggia, where were these Pugliese Jews from? Because I'm a Pugliese.
Uh-huh. Where are you from?
I was born San Ferdinando di
Puglia. Ah, San Ferdinando, okay.
And I was born there, and I always believed my ancestors were Jews. Because based on what my grandmother used to do.
So what was she doing? This is one of the evidence that people generally are looking for, you know?
Well,
they are generally trying to find out whether their grandparents were doing something on Sabbath evening or something like that.
Yes, my mother,
yeah.
Redhead, blue eyes, tiny village. I mean, there's about 10,000.
San Ferdinando, you mean? Yeah, it's very small.
Population, so it's very tiny.
Yeah.
All my families are blue, redhead, blonde, redhead. So, and what she used to do during Passover, prior to Passover, is completely cleanse the house, throw all the bread, and this was, and paint the house. Every year, this was a classic experience, because a tradition, and I experienced because I lived with my grandparents for 10 years. So it was just a constant, on Fridays, you know, there were certain rules not to eat certain foods, because the Italians eat a lot of meat, we eat a lot of meat, but it was only a pesce. You know, it was just fish, sorry. Thank you. So now my dilemma is, how could I find out my roots? Because I actually married a Jewish husband, for over 30 years. And I did go through the conversion, Orthodox conversion, here in Los Angeles. And the rabbis asked me many times, why do you want to convert? And I said, Rabbi, I did this at the La Brea Mikvah, the full 2 years of studies. And what I experienced in my studies is exactly what I was told as a child. And this,
you just have to answer your own question.
Yes.
No, but it's clear. It's
and
clear.
Yeah,
so,
yes.
So okay.
She
so let's start.
She wants to know where they originally came from.
Yeah.
That was her question.
Yes.
So let's go back. Let's go back to the first question. Yeah. Let's go back to the first question. How many Jews were living in Puglia, let's say in the 15th century? Because you may know that Jews were obliged to leave the Kingdom of Naples at mid-16th century, roughly. So we think, although it's not a certain figure, it's not a certain number, we think that there were in the range of 20, 30, 40,000. It's not clear, something like that. Which means that there were many Jews compared to northern Italian communities, which were very small. Where were they located? Everywhere. There's hardly a small, tiny village in Puglia that didn't have at some point a family or two families of Jewish traditions, I mean of Jewish origin. But of course there were major cities, mostly on the seashore, that had the most important communities, like for instance in Trani, as I've said, in Bari, Manfredonia, many other places, okay? Concerning this, I would like it, I'm sorry to say that, this modern trend of reviving a Jewish past, which is very popular, very common in southern Italy, particularly like it's popular in Spain, I'm not that sure that it is possible to trace back the origin today, the origin of a family to Judaism, just basing oneself on these small hints handed down within the family. So for instance, what you were saying about eating fish on Fridays, this is very common among Catholic. I mean, it's the tradition, it's the Catholic tradition. You were saying about cleansing home before Easter, that's very common among Catholic. Being in Puglia myself, I'm from Florence, I discovered Puglia living there, and while there, in the first few years I was there, I was amazed because I myself get in touch with people who are telling me very strange habits, very strange traditions, which could sound somehow Jewish. But then, when I tried to reflect on those traditions, I found out that they were more similar to Byzantine traditions, meaning Greek Orthodox traditions. And what you are saying, I'm sorry to refer in a very bad way, I'm not a specialist again, to this genetic, appearance of your family members, like you red-haired, blue-eyed, and so on and so forth. In my opinion, for my modest knowledge of Apulian population, this is more a sign of influences from the Balkans. You may remember that particularly in the area of San Ferdinando, in the northernmost area of Puglia, contacts with the Slavic population from across the Adriatic Sea were very frequent, all the more so since, especially in the 15th and the 16th century, the local rulers were obliged from time to time to deport people from the other shore of the Adriatic to repopulate, I don't know, the local population after very terrible plagues or epidemic disease that had totally exhausted, so to say, the whole population, the whole local population. There's a very, there used to be, and still nowadays, there are thriving Albanian communities and Slavic communities. They still speak Albanian dialects, Slavic dialects in northern Apulia. And I would rather say, before thinking of a Jewish origin, which is possible, but it's very difficult to prove, I would rather go into the direction of an Albania. For instance, just to give you an example, my wife is from Barletta, which is not far from San Ferdinando, and they have a special recipe for Halloween, which I never found anywhere else. It's a very strange name. It's called Kolva. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Maybe you know. It's a recipe that it's something that you make with pomegranate seeds, and you add other sweet things, and it's something sweet, but not that sweet, and it gives you the idea of honey maybe, or something that you eat to sweeten the day of dead, because it's related to this contact with dead people, with passed away people. And I tried to understand the name, and I wanted to figure out what was the origin of the name, and then I found out that it's a very common Orthodox, Greek Orthodox recipe, which was very popular in Salento in the early Middle Ages. I found a testimony from Salento documents from the 11th century, they are mentioning this specialty with the same name. And then I was speaking about that with some Albanian friends in Florence, and they said, oh, we do the same in Albania. So, I mean, again, we should not forget that nowadays, particularly after the Ottoman conquest of the Byzantine Empire, the Adriatic Sea became a gap between two different worlds. But until then, the Adriatic Sea was a major highway of circulation of ideas, of commerce, of trades, of everything, as the Jewish history demonstrates. Okay, it's very difficult for us, and this is, for me, it's very important, because I'm interested in finding out in literary contacts between Jewish poets that wrote their liturgical poems in Apulia and their colleagues who lived in the Balkans. Sometimes it's really very difficult to demonstrate that a Jewish poet who is supposed to be Apulian was not, in fact, from the Balkans, because the style is the same, traditions are very similar, the way they express this a certain reverence or a certain way to celebrate the festival is more or less the same. And all of this, most of those poems are kept in the liturgy of, for instance, Romagnotti Jews coming from the Byzantine Empire. So it's very difficult to demonstrate even that a Jew whom we know was in Lecce at a certain point in the 15th century was not originally from Greece or the other way around, because we found documents of Jews living in Lecce in the 15th century who are named the certain guy from Corfu or from Thessalonica, for instance. So it's very difficult for that period, because they were going back and forth between the two shores of the Adriatic. So again, I would recommend you to start exploring your ancestors' traditions from an Adriatic point of view.
A quick question. In part, you've already answered it when you were talking of Venice, I think in the 16th and 17th centuries,
you mentioned the distinction between Southern and Northern Italian Jews. Just in broad strokes, can you say a little more on that? What are the distinctions?
Yeah, this is something that constitutes a major part of my research in the last few years. And I'm very interested, I'm still very interested to see what happened with mainly scholarly Jews, I mean academic Jews, mostly physicians, medical doctors, who moved from Apulia to Venice or the Venetian area. Very soon integrated in the local communities, but as you may know, the Jewish community in Venice itself, I mean in the city of Venice itself and in the Venetian state, had a very strong Ashkenazi component since the 14th century. And as you may know, the first Jews who were allowed to live permanently in Venice, especially after the foundation, opening of the gate, or whatever you may call it, were the Ashkenazi Jews, and the first synagogue which was in use in Venice was the German Rite Synagogue. So it's very interesting that those Jews who came from southern Italy and were mainly related to Sephardic traditions immediately changed their mind and adopted the Ashkenazi habits because it was easier for them to live in the city, even because there was no other way to pray. And I found an evidence of this major change in an autobiographic note written by a Venetian philosopher who was of Apulian origin, who says, I wandered about Italy in my childhood until I eventually arrived in Venice, where I found this minhag, meaning the Ashkenazi minhag, which I found more convenient. And from that time on, I'm with them, he says. I pray with them. So it's interesting because what southern Italian Jews were doing, they kept intermarrying. This is shown by document from the documents. This appears from the documents. They kept intermarrying, meaning you find people coming from Naples or from Otranto or from Bari who try to keep their southern Italian traditions, but throughout time, and in a very short lapse of time, like one generation or two generations, they come to marry Ashkenazi Jews or people coming from beyond the Alps, and they create a new Italian Ashkenazi Judaism, which will be the 16th century thriving Judaism in Venice, before the massive arrival of Sephardi Jews, which happens at the end of the 16th, beginning of the 17th century, that will change, in a way, the situation, the Venetian situation. Yeah. So that's the reason why I tried to point out that the situation in Venice was not that different than the situation in Corfu, although in Corfu you didn't have this major Ashkenazi component. You had the Romagnotti component. But there, Jews coming from Italy in Corfu, since Corfu was part of the Venetian state, they kept their neat distinction from the Romagnotti component. So they wanted to be non-Romagnotti. And this is the reason why they kept being more Italian and they kept their Italian traditions rather than Sephardic or other traditions like in the rest of the Ottoman Empire, for instance.
Yes, yes.
I have a non-academic question. What is the difference between the Passover tradition, let's say, food between Northern Ashkenazi Jews and Southern Italians? What do they eat for Passover that's different from each other?
Now, for I don't know if nowadays there still is a Southern Italian tradition for Passover. One of the texts that we found, and it's very interesting, from Corfu, is the Seder, the Passover Seder, with notes in this Judeo-Italian dialect, which was used by the Corfioti Jews, and which is very similar to the Apulian dialect, to put it in a very simple way. But I don't think it is possible to demonstrate. I don't think it's possible to define a specific tradition. On the other hand, it's very interesting to go back, and then you make your following question. To go back to what the lady there was saying, or maybe someone else was pointing out, among the many possible traces of Jewish traditions that I found in Puglia, there's a tradition related to Easter. For instance, again, in my wife's family, they keep doing this. They have a choice of specific foods that they serve at table before the main Easter meal. And this food may remind of the traditional, what you call that in English, food served for the Seder, the traditional plates served for the Seder. Okay? So you have maror, you have bitter, sour vegetables, and then you have a sweet sauce, and then you have these sorts of things. And the strange thing, or interesting things, is that they have the egg, they have all sorts of these things, and on each and every plate, whatever, they make the sign of the cross, or even they pour some olive oil in the shape of a cross, something like that. So it might be that it originally was something different and then passed to the Christian world and was adapted in this way to the Christian world. But then again, I kind of investigated and found out that the Byzantine tradition, I mean the Greek Orthodox tradition, has the same ritual. So I think that it might be that since Greek Orthodox traditions are still more similar to Jewish traditions than Catholic traditions, it might be that originally there was a interference in the Byzantine world with Jewish traditions, and then they brought these traditions to Puglia, and in Puglia they survived till recently, till nowadays, and this is the reason why they seem so weird, so strange, so odd, so bizarre for people coming from northern Italy, because we don't have the same traditions, of course. Excuse me, I interrupted you. You wanted to add something.
What does your family have for Passover?
Sorry?
What does your family have for Passover?
I'm not Jewish, so I only rely on what my friends give me, and that's the point. I know that in Trani, the community of Trani, the recently established community of Trani, is trying, and this is also interesting, it's again a sort of mythological rereading of their traditions, because of course they want to reread their recipes according to Apulian standards. So for instance, they circulate this strange information, which I think it's totally fake, it's totally false, according to which the most typical kind of pasta from Puglia, orecchiette, I think everybody's familiar with orecchiette, it's a pasta in the shape of little ears, so that's the reason why it's called orecchiette, which means little ears. Comes from Provence, and it was introduced by Jewish Provençal traders into Puglia. I don't know where they read something like that. But again, they can now use, for instance, orecchiette for their Passover Seder. because they say that it's a tradition which is originally Jewish. You know? Maybe, who knows?
All right.
Exactly, that's what I say. After 600 years, I don't know if it's possible to say whether this was... But, okay. So,
I'm afraid our formal time is up, but I'm sure that Professor Lodi would be delighted to speak with privately, answer your questions, and I just would like to moderate and just like to thank him once again.
Thank you for your patience.